sleep is a full of crown. Probably they are planning to do a memorial service and the funeral. It's becoming more like a hopeless situation. You just don't know what more can you say. There's a theory that says a lie told many times becomes the truth. But sometimes when a reality happens, whatever you say may become more of a lie because you are not presenting any solutions. I think it's another task and a responsibility that we have. Lastly, I don't know, I'm not good to the, we do have doctors and professors in the house. I'm told that as we'll be dealing with the MTF process, we are short at 50 billion rand. And I was sitting saying, in all what we talk about, even looking at the budgeting system, are we going to be able to move closer? And I hope the minister will find a way to take us out of this. So, because many of the issues that are in the area where we are in this sector require a lot of investment, either to avoid risk or in order to generate revenue that can assist in the services side. Being the case as it may, I will deal with other issues, honorable members. I'm sure when we deal with the minutes, especially on matters arising that I think we need to handle. And with your wisdom, I'm sure we'll be able to move out with a better way. Okay, any apologies?
Good morning, members and the guests. No, I don't have any apologies, Chair. I hear the members are apologizing.
Okay, we... Honorable Jafta.
No, sorry, Chairperson. I just wanted to make an apology in advance to request to be released earlier before 10 o'clock so that I join another portfolio call.
Okay. Honorable Mandel, do you want to contest somebody's apology that has been approved by his party?
In terms of him.
Oh, okay.
No, Chair. I asked my leader, the Honorable Jafta, to lead us in apologies. So likewise, I'd like to submit my apology that I'd render to be excused at 11:30 as I have a medical appointment to attend to at 12. Thank you.
Honorable Smith.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think I may be a bit out of line, but with regards to your comment, I think what we could do, there are weekly reports made available by the Department of Mineral Resources, which on fatality, loss of work time, etc. And it's made available to all the unions on a weekly basis. So it would be good to have those statistics so we can see which mines and which group of companies are responsible for those fatalities. So I think it would help to have a better understanding as to which companies, which mineral resources are being mined, creating the cause. So I think that would be at least one step closer to identifying where the problem may lie. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, it's okay. I was just saying, you know, when almost every week you receive an incident, all what comes to my mind is that that's a human life. the manner, I don't think we can dispute what you are suggesting, except to say I think that information is one of the information we had requested when we were doing the oversight in Gauteng, because it was mainly on health and safety matters. So I think we will deal with that issue. Okay. I was worried, that's what I must tell you, when you were saying, I thought you also wanted to apologize, and I was saying, it seems there's going to be a declaration of time to finish the meeting, indirectly. Okay. We will then get the presentation. On mine closure and rehabilitation, I will allow you, Prof, when you start to introduce yourself. The reason is simple. I hate sometimes, I always say, thanks, I was never in the portfolio committee on police, because I wouldn't know a brigadier from a general and a constable and I know in the academic field they say it's a very treasonous thing to call someone with a title that does not belong to him or her. So I will leave it for you to introduce, and then we'll have questions. The Prof requested that at least when we deal with the questions, because we've got a three-part presentation, we will then deal with questions as per the three-part presentations. That one will agree. Mm-hmm. And subsequent to that, we will deal with the minutes of the... Which one is first? The minutes of the 11th and the 18th. And then we will close or finish or adjourn. I'm now learning this thing. Adjourn the meeting. I thought the meeting that is adjourned is a meeting that is not finished. So we'll adjourn the meeting and continue. Okay, Prof, the floor is yours.
Good morning, everyone, Chairperson, honorable members. I am really excited and I'm honored to be here, and I thank you for the opportunity to present to you today what I know and what I've learned about mine closure and rehabilitation. As the Chairperson has indicated, my presentation is not that long, but it does have three parts. Because I really want to engage you and I want to make sure that I'm communicating effectively, I'd just like to pause after each of those three parts and allow you to pose questions or comments for clarification. So I really want to make 5 points today about mind closure and rehabilitation. Oh, sorry, before I do that, I should actually just say who I am, right? So I am a full professor at Fisk University. I've worked there for 14 years in the School of Law. I am also a consultant attached to Young Earth Attorneys, and my connection to CER, which I've worked with for many years, in fact, since they began. I was involved in setting up the CER, and I'm currently on their board. So those are the various hats that I wear today. So, 5 points about mind closure and rehabilitation. Firstly, that our failure to close minds properly or to deal with the closure situation is impacting the poorest of the poor and the productive capacity of our ecosystems. Secondly, it increases state liability. Thirdly, our end of mine life closure processes are not working. Fourthly, that you've got a number of drivers of those chaotic end of life mine processes, and I will be going through six of those in the presentation. And that finally, that dealing with this problem requires a whole-of-government approach, but with the Department of Mineral Resources overseen by this committee taking the lead. So that's really the take-home messages I want to have today. So this is the first part of my presentation, a little bit about context. We're looking at a definition, the idea of mind closure and trauma, and then three slides on the different kinds of processes that are implicated in mind closure. You have this idea of mind closure, but you have a whole lot of processes overlying each other. And I just want to break those down because they really speak to understanding what the drivers are. So this is a definition of mind closure that comes from the literature. It's Daniel Limpet Law. He does a lot of work in Africa. He's associated with the Center for Sustainable the CSMI at WITS. And this is quite a positive definition. The process of transforming an active mine into a set of safe and stable landforms that are non-polluting and provide habitat and ecosystem services, supporting activities by the new land users. And it's actually a definition that fits in with the latest thinking about mine closure. The very first ideas about it were really driven about trying to reclaim the land. The first kind of conflict that arose was in the late 1800s in California with hydraulic gold mining. By the 1960s, people were talking about reclamation of mine sites. Then they started talking about remediation, where you've got to try and make the site stable so that it's physically stable. You don't have ash dumps collapsing on people or dunes collapsing. It's physically stable, and it's chemically stable. You don't have a situation where you've got all the substances that have been disturbed by the activity of mining going into the soil, going into the water, and going into the air. So that idea of stabilizing it physically and chemically, and that's where the idea of remediation came into effect. But the latest thinking about it is that it is about regeneration. That we want to have these sites economically active after mining. So it's not about trying to keep people out, but trying to have a post-mined land use where you can have economic activity. And there's a lot of innovative thinking about what kind of land uses there could be. So this is really, you know, talks about new land uses. It's in line with that kind of thinking. That's just the development of the literature. But in South Africa, we have this idea of mine closure and trauma. And the background document that Martin prepared, which I thought was a very good background document, starts with that line. A huge amount of trauma is associated with the closure of mines. Loss of jobs, safety issues, you know, not just mine workers dying in the mines, children swimming in these mine canals, people falling into sinkholes and losing their lives. So there's loss of life while mining occurs, but there's loss of life after mine closure. The entrance of the Zamazamas into these sites and a deteriorated security situation. And then just some of the quotes from that background paper. These associations of trauma and death and ending. And we can all relate to that. Now, I want to outline three sets of processes that are implicated in mine closure. And they all relate to the mine trajectory. So typically, you know, you can break this down further, but typically you have an exploration phase where you're looking for the mineral and you're looking for a deposit, and at that time the state wants investment, they want mines to come in. Then you have a process of developing the mine, which may take a number of years. Then you have the operation phase, which is really the phase where we earn taxes for development, which is the main benefit we get from mining, not jobs, I'm sorry. And then finally we have this process of mine closure. Now the three processes, the end of mine processes, that are sort of most closely associated with mine closure, it's the process of decommissioning that mine and rehabilitating that site. And typically that'll involve, you know, trying to get, so you've got this huge pile of tailings that you want to be stable, moving that around, making sure that it's stable, taking down certain kinds of machinery, just decommissioning the site and then trying to make it stable. You have the legal process of relinquishment, which I'll say a little bit more about, and then you have a process of the management of residual and latent risk. So those are the processes that are involved at the end of the life of the mine. That process of relinquishment is very important for state liability, because it is the moment, it is the authorization moment where the risk can shift from the private sector to the public sector. And in our law, it's governed by Section 43 of the MPRDA. So at that point, the mining company will say, we've done everything according to our closure plan. We now think that we can get closure and we want a closure certificate. And that is given by the Department of Mineral Resources in consultation with the Department of Water. The legal implication of that currently, and in most countries of the world, is that the operator is then released from liability, and the government can access the funds that have been set aside for financial provision. So it's a very important regulatory process. So that's the end of mine processes. The next layer of processes is what I call closure processes. And they are in my mind, more important, because they are the things that you need to do even before the mind starts operating and while the mind is operating to make sure that you don't have a chaotic situation at the end of the life of the mind. The first of those processes is integrated closure planning. So before you even start your mining operation, you think about what kind of land use you can have post-mine. You look at the reserve, you look at how many years you're going to operate, you look at the characteristics of the land, and you think, okay, that could be used for biofuels later on, or that's going to be wilderness. And so you set your closure objective. Our law says something about closure objectives, but it's quite unrealistic. It says the mined land will be returned to its natural or predetermined state, which is impossible. You will never get that same land use capability back because you've disturbed the land so much. In our law, we do have something of that already in our 2014 Environmental Impact Assessment Regulations. They require the operator to have a closure plan when they submit the Environmental Impact Assessment. And there's a lot of literature in the world about how you do this thing of integrated closure planning. The next process is setting aside your financial provision. That is also globally, that's what countries require mining companies to do. In South Africa, it can either be money in the bank, or it can be a trust fund, or it can be a bank guarantee, and the latest regulations also allow for insurance. So it's the idea of setting aside a bit of money that accumulates over the course of the mine's operation so that you have enough by the end of the life of the mine to deal with those decommissioning processes, rehabilitation processes, and managing residual and maintenance impacts. Our new set of financial provision regulations under the single environmental system really try to tighten things up. However, their workability is not yet tested. And the implementation of those regulations rests with the Department of Mineral Resources. So it's very important that those work so that we have enough by the time the mine is closed to deal with those impacts. And then the last process is just annual or progressive rehabilitation. So you don't want these closure processes only happening right at the end. You know, it's just common sense. You want to be, while you are mining, making sure that you're taking care of the topsoil. You're not contaminating that topsoil with waste rock, because one of the most important things to have at the end is soil that you can actually grow something in. So those are our closure processes. So it's end of mine life processes and then closure processes. And now the third set of processes, for me the most interesting, is what I call the operating company processes. So you have this mine trajectory, you have all these things, processes happening to closure, but then there are things that the company can do to adapt itself to a changing situation. And those processes enable mining companies to avoid their liability. In 2014, I wrote a paper called MPRDA Facilitating Dereliction, or something along those lines, which really looks at the kinds of things companies can do in company law to evade their liability. So what are those processes? The first is just a process of specializing or contracting out. So the company that does the exploration might not be the company that eventually mines, firstly. Or there might be processes of contracting out that work. The second set of processes occurring during the development and operation of the mine enable the operator to change. So either you could have a sale of shares, the ownership and control of the company can change, or you can have the sale of the mine. Or you can have processes of business rescue where other operators are brought in. So the important thing to take home is that you're not necessarily dealing with one mining company throughout their trajectory. You've got change. And in all those changes from one operator to another, you have to make sure that this institutional memory about closure is maintained and that the liability is not suddenly changed. Now, there are processes in company law to deal with those changes. So under the Companies Act, you've got a section dealing with fundamental transactions, for example. When Anglo sells however many of its platinum mines, might be going through a process dealing with fundamental transactions. You've got business rescue regulated by the Companies Act. And then you've got winding up, which I'll talk a bit later too as well. And the point I want to make later on in the presentation is that those processes don't help us with mind closure. They are a way for companies to avoid their liability because those closure obligations do not feature in the processes of business rescue. And that's why you can have a situation like Aurora and Grootvlei and Village Main Reef and DRD Goldenvlei for Eetzacht, where no one is taking responsibility for the situation. So the main regulatory frameworks there are the Companies Act and then Section 11 of the MPRDA, because you have to have some kind of process when one mining right is transferred from one operator to another, and that's done by Section 11 of the MPRDA. But that it doesn't cover every situation. I won't go into the technicalities, I'm just saying it's not a perfect process, Section 11 transfers. You also have practices associated with illicit financial flows. So a mining company is not going to, the company that holds the mining right is not going to be the company that has the assets. It's going to be the company that is burdened with debt. And, you know, the whole international framework understanding of illicit financial flows, trade mispricing, the way that holding companies can burden their subsidiaries with debt, has relevance here. And then the other very important process is putting mines on care and maintenance, which is, in actual fact, I think in South Africa is a kind of de facto closure process, which is largely unregulated at the moment. And then finally, winding up in liquidation. And that is really the bridge to abandonment. Because once that company no longer exists, who are you going to deal with? Who are you going to sue? Who are you going to task to be liable? So that ends the first part of my presentation. I would like to open it up for any questions on anything, clarification or comments. Shall I continue? Are there no...
That's how I continue.
Can I continue?
Any questions?
Can I ask a question?
Honourable Member.
If you don't complain about time, because I said when he does, when he finishes, we'll then go according to the three parts when you ask questions.
Oh, okay. So you don't want me to ask questions now, should we take
them? Once you finish,
okay.
We'll go with
excellent.
Part one, part
okay.
two, and then part three.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you. So coming back now to my five main points, that poorly regulated mine closure impacts the poorest of the poor and the productive capacity of our ecosystems. I'm not going to say too much here, and I'm simply going to point you into this research that has already been done. So there have been four excellent recently produced reports on the effects of mines and mine closure on communities and ecosystems. The first was done by Harvard Law School on the effects of acid mine drainage and the human rights implications of that process. The second, a very detailed study on Blaeford Eetzacht, which is the kind of poster child for chaotic mine closure in South Africa, done by the OSCE for Human Rights. Then a study on coal, water and mining in the Delmas area. And the one that I think is the best, really, is the Benchmarks work. You know, Benchmarks is quite an incredible organization. I was at the AGM on Monday. They really try to ground their research in evidence. This is a result of a three-year project where they looked at four different communities in and around Soweto. And they had a control community, and they looked at all kinds of health impacts, the impact of the dust, the air pollution, the water, the tailings. I really urge you to read that report, read the executive summary. One of the recommendations in your briefing background paper is to have Benchmarks come and present to you. I really would encourage you to do that because you'll get a real sense on the ground of how it is impacting people. The second point, poorly regulated mine closure increases state liability. So I've just listed a few of the cost items of poorly regulated mine closure there, and they run into tens and hundreds of millions, if not billions. You know, I'm positive that you have heard this figure that there are 6,000 ownerless mines. We don't like to say derelict. There are 6,000 earners less mines in South Africa, and the bill on that, the remediating that, is 60 billion rand, and we do something like 5 a year. We concentrate on asbestos. That's a lot of money. The cost of AMD remediation, I haven't looked at the latest figures on that, but it runs into the hundreds of millions. Something like the Carolina water crisis, where that local authority's potable water was contaminated by acid mine drainage. What is the cost of that? The unquantified health costs, not just of water pollution, but the dust, the respiratory problems, which comes out very strongly in that benchmark study. Police resources expended upon informal mining and mine-related conflicts. I'll talk a little bit later about the work of an investigative journalist, Mark Ollald, who's probably done more than anyone else in the NGO community to really get out information about mine closure in South Africa. But he said that, like, something between the police services received 2,200 calls relating to security situations on these abandoned mine sites. So there are police resources going into this. And then just the unraveling, the quick unraveling of the security situation, if you don't keep that process in hand, and there's a short window of time to do it. You know, there are pictures of Namibian security forces on Blaeford 86 sites, and stories of people being brought in from the DRC to control the security in an urban, you know, urban context close to. It's really not something we want. It's not a good picture of economic and social stability. So for those reasons, it's really important to deal properly with mine closure. My third point is that is around how our end-of-life closure processes are not working. And I'm just going to concentrate on two things, the closure certificates and the financial provision. So this comes out of the work that Mark Ollald did. He got some grant money to come here in South Africa, and he sent out PIA requests to the Department of Mineral Resources and the regional offices. And for some reason, they gave him the information. But he was able to find out how many closure certificates have actually been granted between 2011 and 2016. And that table provides you with a useful summary of what kinds of operations are being granted closure certificates. Now, the most important column there is the first one, the closure certificates for mining rights. And you can see there that 27 have been granted. None have been granted in Gauteng. None have been granted in Mpumalanga. Where are our gold mining and coal mining regions? Most of our closure certificates are being granted for very small operations. So the mining permits, you can see there, 363, and for prospecting rights, 288. So mining companies are not applying for closure certificates, and the DMR is not granting them. The second, and I speak with this case about caution, because my attention has only just been drawn to it, and I'm working with a postdoc researcher on understanding what's going on in this situation. But what is happening is that in certain areas, development is taking place. There's a very well-known, in fact, it's even won awards, property development in Johannesburg, where land is being developed, but the closure certificates have allegedly not been granted. And for that case, I found a local authority government gazette, and it's very, very small, but what it says there is that the mine company involved will not be liable for any subsidence caused to housing in that development. It's from 2014. So you have a situation where closure hasn't been granted, we haven't sorted out the liability, and they're building houses on this mined land. So a kind of regulatory vacuum. On the financial provision, what Mark's research also uncovered was that there is apparently 60 billion rand available, which just seems to cover our mine closure, abandonment and derelict owner bill, but we can't use it for that. That money is not for derelict and ownerless mines. It's for currently operating mines. 60 billion rand available for mine rehabilitation and sites, but it is unused because mines are not legally closed. So you can read there, held in funds, and Department of Mineral Resources can only access it if it is closed. Otherwise, we have to rely on the mining companies. We have to rely on those trustees of the trust funds to actually make sure that money is used. But that is money that could potentially be put to job creation, around mind closure. Okay. Now the next point is the one I want to break down, because I want to talk about the drivers of this situation. Why are our mind closure processes not working? So I've got 6 points there, 6 points. A single point liability shifting closure certification process. I think that's problematic. Unclear regulatory leadership on care and maintenance. Our generic company law regulation that does not articulate with closure processes. The model, amount, and fragmentation of financial provision. Unimaginative, poorly conceptualized, poorly enforced integrated closure planning, and a lack of transparency. So I'm going to go into that, and that will really be the bulk of my presentation, and then I'll be finished and you can ask questions. So the first point about the single point certification process. Do you remember that slide where I talk about the end of life mine processes in Section 43 and the granting of the closure certificate? So in South Africa and even internationally, we have this idea that it's orderly, you know, that you'll get to that point and it'll apply, but now people are talking about it as a myth. And there are countries in the world where they don't operate on the basis of the single point closure certification process, where there is a process of managing the risk. So you don't have this like one point where you say the government has to suddenly think, oh my God, I'm not taking on all this liability. It is possible to avoid that. The research shows that most mines don't close in a planned way for a variety of reasons. It could be geological. The reserve might not be what they expected. There could be some huge accident. The market might change. You might have labor issues. For a whole number of reasons, mines do not close as planned. The normal is that it is sudden. The second thing related to the single point certification process, that you'll have some point in time where there will be closure certification, is that we have a mindset where we have to carry on mining at all costs. And you can see it in the Blaeffer example. We never want to stop mining. So what happens is that we start getting more and more precarious and shady mining operators coming in to work those sites. And then what happens is that whatever assets were there become dissipated, and the situation deteriorates. You've got zamazamas entering the site, and it just deteriorates. So is it possible to draw a line in the sand, to say we're not going to grant more mining rights for these kinds of land areas, or even to have partial closure? Our law currently doesn't allow for partial closure. It was raised in the Blaeffer 86 case. They wanted to have some kind of partial closure, but it wasn't possible. There are countries in the world that allow for that. But at the moment, we're just saying, you know, if we can get investment, you know, eventually some kind of scavenger miner coming in, we'll take it. And the processes for business rescue and winding up facilitate that. Those are just pictures from the Blaeffer 86 site. The one is showing a mine tunnel being... sorry, you don't have pictures. Oh, it's not very good. It's not very nice. Showing a tunnel where the Zamazamas are working, and that is a member of the Namibian security forces, apparently, from Moscow. And this is research that has been done on the perceptions of mining managers and mining professionals and mining experts by Milton Miller-Russ and his colleagues. And he asked them, why aren't you applying for closure certificates? And this is what they said. The requirements to reduce mitigated risk to zero is unattainable, and since it cannot be achieved, no mines are getting closure permits. This means that the best possible practices are being rejected, and since undertaking best practice brings no reward, mines are not bothering to do their best. And then also that it is a political impossibility to close a mine. Okay, so that's my point on that single point certification process. The next driver is around care and maintenance. We don't really... How many mines are on care and maintenance in South Africa? Do we know? There's not... You see in the media all these reports. I just did a search and pulled up what I know. Those are the ones that are reported. With the establishment of the single environmental system and the financial provision regulations in 2015, The Department of Environmental Affairs tried to regulate care and maintenance. And I've just, in my slide, put down the various things that had happened around. So in the financial provision regulations, there was and there still is a section on care and maintenance. And it just has some sort of regulatory process around doing an impact assessment, getting some sort of approval for that. These are very contentious processes. Last year, I sat in the hearings of the South African Human Rights Commission. I was an independent panelist. For 5 days, I sat listening to people make submissions about these and many other things. The Twickenham mine, Anglo Platinum, extremely contentious process where they want to put it into care and maintenance. It hasn't even gone into operation yet. So it's conflictual processes. It's not an anodyne process. The industry has pushed back on these regulations, and in a meeting we attended in March 2017, the Department of Environmental Affairs was saying that they were going to step back from trying to regulate that. But through the amendments to the financial provision regulations that have taken place, those regs are still there. But what seems to me to be the case is that no one is taking leadership on this. No one is taking action to say, yes, this is, you know, this is a sign of corporate distress. It could potentially lead to a situation where we've got business rescue and winding up. Let's pay attention. And let's step in and see what we can do to make sure that the situation remains stable. So my main point here is that care and maintenance is happening, it's not regulated, and we don't have leadership. Okay, articulation with company law processes. I've already said something about this when I talked about those adapting company law procedures. For me, there are signs of corporate distress where the government starts needing to pay attention. Mentioned fundamental transactions, business rescue, and winding up. I do have more information on these processes in the annexure to my slides. I didn't want to make your eyes glaze over with all the technical detail. In my experience, these processes are poorly understood by the Department of Mineral Resources. I was in the AGM meeting of benchmarks, as I said, on Monday, and the Deputy Minister made a comment that when a company is in business rescue, the DMR can do nothing. That is not actually the case. If you look at the Company Laws Act, it does not stop regulatory proceedings against the company provided that the authority notifies the business rescue practitioner. Because the whole idea of that business rescue process is that you have a stay of proceedings against the company in business rescue. But there is an exception made for regulatory authorities. So that level of understanding of stuff that is there is not there. But then there is also things in those processes that are not there, especially winding up. And that is the most concerning of the processes. Because you can wind a company up without anybody even being aware. There's not a requirement that you notify the DMR or the DEA. It's only the shareholders and the unions. This company adaptation facilitates dereliction, and there is a need for the DMR to work alongside the Department of Trade and Industry and the Department of Justice, because winding up involves liquidators that report to the Office of the Master. I have done a detailed analysis of that. Part of the law, it's still our old Companies Act. We don't even have in our new Companies Act regulations on winding up. It's still referred to the 1970s Act. On the various roles, but there is... It doesn't fit well because it was drafted in the 1970s, and we've got a situation now in 2000 dealing with mine closure. Okay, that's just an overview. You have this information in your background document about what happened at Blaeford. You know, there was a business rescue process in 2011. That's how Village Main Reef came onto the scene. Then they walked away. Then the Blaeford Access Mining Company initiated winding up proceedings. At that point, Village Main Reef and DRD Gold are saying no one is responsible. The liquidators got in a company, Goldridge Holdings. They were associated with Aurora. They were not able to meet their contractual payments. They then spent 5 months in court trying to get them off the site. In the meantime, assets are stripped. Eventually, they got them out. Goldridge itself goes into business rescue, and then they finally got in a new developer, Peter Skeet, and has acquired the assets for about 250 million rand. Showing how quickly the situation has unraveled and how business rescue, as it is currently formulated and winding up, are not helping us deal with the situation. Okay, so in summary, what happens if we don't make sure that there's articulation between the closure processes and the company processes, so we get more precarious operators. These considerations do not feature in these processes. There's no priority for environmental claims. There's lack of awareness on the part of the regulatory authority that these are happening. There's a lack of understanding and knowledge of liquidators and business rescue practitioners. But, and then without regulatory closure, the DMR can't access the financial provision. So I really feel very strongly that it's important to pay attention and to get some kind of alignment. And we would be the first among countries in the world to start paying attention to this. You know, I presented in May, I went to Scotland, the Centre for Energy, Mineral and Petroleum. It's the leading centre for energy and mineral law in the world. And I talked about this, and no one was talking about it. So we have an opportunity to lead here. Okay, the financial provision as a driver. I think the point here, I'm going to concentrate first on the fact that there's not enough. Our financial provision regulations only entered into force in November 2015. We have not been setting aside enough financial provision. Those are some of the ridiculous cases that show that the lack, the disparity between the levels required and the levels that are set out. Goldview, which is a company that was criminally prosecuted for environmental transgressions in Mpumalanga. $622 million in liabilities, but $29 million in the Environmental Rehabilitation Fund, $5 million in the Trust Fund. APA Advent Africa, which is about mining in the Mabola protected environments, pristine environments, the start of a number of our important river systems, a strategic water area, and they're putting aside $5.8 million. That will not even buy you a nice house in Sea Point. You know, it's not enough money. The second is the way we think about financial provision. So we have this like set-aside model that you take a bit of money and you set it aside and it takes away from your operating capital. We're not thinking creatively about how you can actually raise capital for mine closure costs. And through the developments that are now taking place, for example, in that area of Johannesburg, it is possible to have investment in post-mine land. So there are provisions in the Companies Act that we could use to actually raise capital. So we can think beyond just setting aside financial provision. I don't think that's a problem. And the other aspect of it is that the financial provision is so fragmented. You know, it's little pots here and there. There's very little actual money in accounts. It's mostly bank guarantees, and it is trust funds. But it's in little pots everywhere. Sometimes you might have one financial fund for a whole lot of mines, and that's problematic. How do you actually leverage that? How do we get, you know, make the use of those funds effective? So we don't even know really if 60 billion rand is available. That is just the work that Mark has done. So I think there that we need, firstly, rigorous new application of our financial provision regulations, and the DMR must be making sure that there is enough. We need to think about the model, and we need to find out what's happening with the 60 billion and somehow put it to work. And then just to say from my colleague Milton's research, inadequate funding is the prime challenge facing sustainable mine closure. Okay, on integrated closure planning. Although we have it in our law, you know that old story of how we have good laws but we don't have implementation applies here. So we're not doing enough around our baseline indicators. And Milton's research established that we've got good monitoring on water, we've got some monitoring on indicators on dust, but especially our soil and the way that the ecological system works together as a system is not well monitored. Closure costing exercises are inaccurate. Integrated closure planning is not being conducted, so it's just a compliance exercise where you have submitting your closure plan with your environmental authorization, but it's not actually carried through. Our closure objectives are unrealistic. During the life of the mine, our operational monitoring is insufficient. Again, those are the parameters that the research found is not optimal. And we have to have good enforcement during that time. And really, that buck is going to stop with the DMR. the Tallman case, it was here in the Western Cape, where the Department of Environmental Affairs tried to intervene to deal with this situation. I don't know if you can see that on the slides, but try and look. That is a serious environmental transgression. The Department of Environmental Affairs stepped in to deal with that situation. The DMR did not step into that situation. But then the court set aside the magistrate's court that allowed the DA to get in there. So really our hope rests with the DMR to make sure that we have good integrated closure planning, we have good financial provision, that we have enforcement of that during the life of the mine. And then finally, a lack of transparency. Companies try to keep details of their financial provision secret. I don't think that's surprising, because then everyone would realize how little there was actually available. The government until recently has also been unwilling to make those details available. I'm told from the CER that PIE requests are being granted, but then the documentation is simply not being made available. There are existing closure requirements, so there is a disclosure law. Our environmental authorization regulations require certain kinds of information to be made available. However, companies are not doing that. And if we had disclosure, we would have more minds thinking about that. You would have independent assessment of the financial provision. You'd have more people thinking about it. And you wouldn't have the government rubber stamping of what the mining companies are saying is sufficient. So it just opens up collective consciousness about this process. And then finally, this is something I've put in because I've recently been doing work with some government departments about open data. You know, we have an open data portal that we're developing. The DPSA is developing that. Hugely exciting initiative. Treasury has an amazing initiative about open data. Why can't we bring open data to the mineral resources sector and have things like the financial provision available, that you could play with that information, you could find out what is happening? Social labor plans is another thing that could be on the open data portal. But it's going to depend on the willingness of the DMR to actually make that information available. There's nothing in law that compels them to make it available. Okay, so finally, given all those drivers, we really need a whole of government response. The DMR must take the lead. The oversight bodies, this committee, I think that the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation should get involved. Through informal discussions with some of them, I have had, you know, the sense that they actually want to get involved. I got that sense of the Human Rights Commission. When we were asking the DMR for statistics, how many mines are closed? How many mines are in strategic water areas? What is your meta-statistics on social and labor plans? And we called them back three times, and they were not able to give us that information. So it's a concern to me that you don't have that broad level understanding of what is happening in the sector. And that's why I have a sense that performance monitoring and evaluation could get involved. The Department of Environmental Affairs is very important, water and sanitation, but then also DTI, Department of Justice, and the Department of Labor for labor issues. Okay, so I'm hoping that my presentation today has opened up some questions that you may have, questions that I have. For me, the overarching question is what should be the short, medium, and long-term priorities for addressing our mine closure problem? I think we have a mine closure problem. I don't think that is the question. But what do we do about it? How do we get leadership on care and maintenance? How do we get accountability for the rigorous implementation of our environmental impact assessment regulations and financial provision regulations? How do we initiate an inquiry about a policy debate about the existing funds that are available? How do we articulate between company laws and mine closure laws? And how do we monitor performance? So thank you for your attention. That is my email, my VITS email. I really would like to avail my resources. I didn't mention at the start, but I have been working on a book, which will hopefully be published next year, God willing, which has been looking at mining, the role of the state in mining and environment and development throughout the world, concentrating on property taxation, environmental management, and mine closure, and really looking at innovative examples around sustainability from various countries in the world and really trying to track the main issues. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Prof. You didn't introduce your colleague. Except if she wants to introduce herself.
Good morning, Chair and Committee. Thank you. My name is Catherine Horsfield. I'm an attorney at the Center for Environmental Rights, and I head the mining program there. And just to thank you for the opportunity to come and present today.
Okay. Thanks very much. Okay. Your three-part, Prof, first it deals with the context, which is more of an interpretative perspective. The second one is the one that deals with the regulation, the shortcomings and the weaknesses in terms of the regulatory framework. The last one is
the driver.
Okay.
Yeah,
and then, so there might be four with the bullet that you released at the end.
Yes.
The broader question
okay.
of leadership and so forth.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. I nearly said Professor Lorim. Honorable Lorima, can we deal then with the first part in terms of the questions on the context?
All right. I'll ask the first question, which is, and then come back. I'm not ready for my other ones yet. And the first one is a sort of a philosophical thing about restoration and what do you think the intention should be? It sounds like you've moved away from the idea that land should be restored to. The hope that land should be restored to a pristine condition. You'd be quite comfortable with it being restored to an condition of, say, economic usefulness. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Asked and answered.
If I could just comment on that. The scientists tell me it's impossible. You won't get that back. You know, you are disturbing the geology, you're disturbing the whole functioning of that ecosystem. The research on all our grassing of dumps, you know, over so many years, that property development that I mentioned, I found a paper that looks at the effectiveness of the grassing, you know, from the 1960s. You don't get it back. We have to realize, you know, we say mining, there's this argument, is mining a temporary land use or not? And we say it's a temporary land use. It's not a temporary land use, but we don't have words to describe what kind of land use it is. It's a transformative land use. We need to acknowledge that.
Honorable Smith. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've just had the advantage of going to Australia, and I think we learned a lot from their processes. But I was expecting you to have more emphasis on continuous rehabilitation. I think that's basically the approach by the Australian authorities because of the problems you've indicated. I understand that the legal framework is such that you can't use the funds, as you've indicated, for continuous rehabilitation because of the reasons. Would that, to a certain extent, deal with many of the problems? I would guess so. I mean, I'm not as informed as you are, but it would probably deal with it from inception phase right through to, as you would call, continuous operational planning, I think you call it.
Yeah.
So that's the one question. The second issue is, and I'm not sure whether it's part A, B, or C, but if I understand correctly, I always thought until quite recently that the funds are there to ensure that you can rehabilitate. You seem to suggest there must first be a closure certificate and then the funds become available. For some reason, I always thought that in order to gain the closure certificate, you could use the funds at a stage and point in time, whatever that would be, and then say, listen, DMR, I've now rehabilitated, I now want my closure certificate. You seem to indicate, no, it's the other way around. So that creates a problem because it expects mining companies at the end of the life of mine to now start spending funds which they normally don't have because they're trying to extend the life of mine, as you've indicated. And then companies with low overheads and who can then mine optimally, economically, then start entering the fray, and then when they can't, a smaller venture then steps in and then starts. So you find a position where at the end, as you've indicated, scavengers start mining who don't have the capital, such as the Anglos and the BHP Billitons, because in order to mine that mine economically, smaller and smaller mining companies do so. So I'm not sure whether I raised a, put a question there, but I think the idea... Sorry?
I need to clarify.
Yes, please. Then, I also back to Australia. The Australian, and maybe I must make one philosophical remark. We found one thing very different in Australia to here. The willingness of mining companies to cooperate with the authorities. It was quite palpable. In fact, to the extent that some of us asked the question, just to repeat the, the message that... But here we seem to have the opposite. And I don't want to go into the reasons. But the reason why I'm mentioning it is because in Australia, the government has now, relatively recently, in the last year or so, implemented or introduced legislation where every mining company operating and exploration companies contribute to a rehabilitation fund in respect of derelict and ownerless mines. Not even historically their responsibility, but that's the sense of cooperation and the sense of ownership the current mining companies have in terms of historical mining. Do you think that's a legally a possibility that we have 60 billion rand, I thought last figure was 50 billion, but 60 billion, I think we're spending, I worked it out at some stage, 0.001% of what is required annually. We're not going to get it done in 100 years at this rate. So that's maybe one way of looking at it. Maybe your more informed view as to could, do you think it would be advisable for mining companies to say, listen, historically you as a sector are responsible and therefore do similar to what's happening in Australia. And then I think I have one more last issue, if I could just see what I've written here. Tormund Mine. We've been to the Tormund Mine. It was a very instructive visit. But the court case on that mine, if I understand correctly, was not that DMR, that environmental affairs were not allowed to, as in principle, as in legal measure, not allowed to. The procedures followed was not sufficient, or the reasons given for the warrant by the magistrate was not sufficient to have authorized the warrant. And therefore, but it still remains, in my view, a joint responsibility of DEA and DMR. There was a point I wanted to make. I can't remember. But I'll end there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you come back, okay.
Yeah, you come back.
Okay.
Honourable Smith, thank you for your question. So, on the first question of the continuous rehabilitation, yes, absolutely. And to my mind, that is part of integrated closure planning. So that would be set out in your environmental authorization, your environmental management program, your closure plan. The interesting thing for me is that there's nothing in the law that actually says you must do annual rehabilitation, you must progressive rehabilitate. We don't have something that specific. In the financial provision regulations, the DIA tried to do that because they say your financial provision has three parts. So it's your annual rehabilitation, your decommissioning and closure, and then residual and latent defects. When we had discussions earlier this year, they were saying, the industry has said to us, you can't put that annual rehabilitation in your closure plan. So they're actually taking that out. So there's nothing that you know, legally compels you apart from your environmental authorization, which is a law. That must just be properly done. But the way that the DIA, which now has authority to, you know, and mandate and jurisdiction to determine, they're trying to use the financial provision to make sure that companies do annual rehabilitation. That is the policy thrust, as far as I could understand it. But yes, that's where we need to focus. On the second question of the funds to rehabilitate, I need to clarify. I was not saying that those funds cannot be used at all. They can't be used by the government. So they can be used by mining companies. But then you're depending on the mining companies to actually do it. And if you look at what's happening with the trust fund around Blaefel Uitzicht, and if you want a submission of that, you know, Mariette Liffer and company would be happy to come do a presentation for you there. It's difficult because DRD Gold is not wanting to release that money, and there was lack of clarity on who was the actual operator. So it's very dispersed and fragmented. How do you get action on that? But if you have the government needs the closure certificate to actually legally access those funds. Although there are other technicalities around when, you know, the minister can get control of those bank guarantees, which I don't want to go into all those details now. So that was my point. I wasn't saying that they can't be used at all. Obviously they must be used.
That's why.
But there are tax implications as well. You know, there's the Income Tax Act has a provision, so you've got to use those funds for rehabilitation. The third question on the willingness of the mining companies to cooperate, yes. I think that's a tragedy. Australia works better together. I'm not saying it's perfect, and I don't think Australia does a good job when they come here. But they've worked to be better together much, much more than us. I mean, they've developed standards. NGOs working together with mining companies, working together with government. There's so many standards. And that would work. On Monday, I heard someone from the Chamber of Mines saying they're struggling to even get mining companies to work together. And that is the kind of level he presented at that AGM I was talking about, and he was saying we're trying to get mining companies to speak to each other so that they know what's happening on with their social and labour plans. So at the moment you have different mining companies each having their social labour plan, and they're not speaking to each other. So cooperation between mining companies is one issue. Cooperation with the rest of, you know, how do we get a cooperative model rather than a conflictual model, which is where we're stuck in at the moment. The regional fund is, that's Western Australia, right? That has implemented that regional mine closure. So there are a few countries in the world, and I did work last year for the International Council of Mining and Metals. We did a survey of some countries, and we found that there is this trend starting to see where countries are trying to, you know, put it in one pot, and Western Australia is an example of that. So yes, it is a trend, it is a possibility. How do you get that to work in South Africa? You know, there's been so much legislative change. It's something to think about. And sorry, your fourth point, I didn't...
It was just a remark. I can't remember the question myself, but it was something about Tormund Mine
The... Would you like to speak to that, Catherine?
Thank you. My understanding of the judgment, I haven't read it for a few months, is that it was very clearly a jurisdictional point. Mm-hmm. To the extent that there was a procedural aspect that was to do with the steps that have to be taken before the DEA can intervene, but the judgment was very squarely placing the jurisdiction of environmental enforcement with the DMR with the commencement of the One Environmental System, and booted DEA out on that basis.
Honourable Mandela.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. I would like to take this opportunity to appreciate the presentation put to us by Professor Tracy Hambi and her colleague. Perhaps let me try and understand this part, Honourable Chair. You made mention that rehabilitation cannot entirely happen in the sense that once you have removed the topsoil, it's virtually impossible to get it back in right, effective use. Now, we've been on an oversight tour in KwaZulu-Natal and visited Richards Bay Mineral. And by my limited understanding, I suppose that was the far best model I've seen in terms of rehabilitation. They mine pitch sand, and as soon as they move from that, they rehabilitate it to as best as possible to its natural environment. But also for the traditional leaders and the communities around there, they've been able to plant indigenous as well as a commercial forest for the communities to be able to be sustainable and engage with the likes of SAPI and Mondi. Would you therefore say that is not entirely correct in your assessment if you say that you cannot be able to entirely restore and rehabilitate the land to its full use? Because on my side, I could say that I've seen a model. We've been there as a committee, and I think that is by far the best model I've come across. So I'd like to get your input in that regard. But I have also a problem, Honorable Chair, on this issue of ownerless and derelict mines. Now we have a history, a century-long mining operations happening. And now some of these mines that you have well identified are sitting as ownerless and derelict mines were actual mines that were mined by powerhouses of today and were left. Are you therefore saying that as government we don't have a role in terms of department to ensure on our oversight as this committee? We insist that those companies be held accountable for ensuring those mines are rehabilitated, because they are sitting with the huge profits today because they were let to get away with such in the past. And I'd like to gain your understanding in that regard. Thank you.
Honorable Mandela, thank you. So I'm not saying that successful examples of rehabilitation don't exist. I do think, and I'm not a scientist, you know, I'm a lawyer. So I do depend on what I read, what I hear from people that are working, for example, with me. If it's my understanding, it's impossible to get it to its previous state. You can restore it to some level of functionality that might approximate different levels of pristineness, but you'll never get it back to its full, what it was before. So, or, you know, what is natural? That's what our law says, to its natural or predetermined state or to use that conforms to sustainable development. It's commodity specific as well. So I don't know what the commodity was that was mined at Richards Bay, but different commodities present different challenges. So gold on the Witwatersrand is difficult, because you've got, just because of the nature of the reserve and the fact that there was uranium in those tailings. Coal is very difficult. See, it really depends on the commodity. My sense, from the work that I've done, also internationally last year, we were trying to get best case studies for the International Council of Mining and Metals, and we could find very few. So I don't think that it's a realistic or practical goal to say it must be natural or pristine or what it was before. We need to think broader than that. I think that's the, and if there are, for example, all the, now with climate change adaptation, and I have a PhD student who's going to be working with Chikondeni mine on this, there are new opportunities that open up as well of what you can use that land for. On your second point on the ownerless mines, yes, I also have a problem with it. It's a travesty. Secondly, and it should be possible to trace the owners. And I, from what I understand, the Council of Geoscience has that information. I have seen various spreadsheets, but again, where is the transparency? Where is the information? Let's have it out there. I would like to suggest, you know, if this committee does see itself playing a role in that regard, that is the very first appeal you call DRD Gold and Village Main Reef to this committee and you ask them what is happening around the trust funds for Blefarete. That would be of lack of first port of action. But, you know, the more time elapses, the more difficult it becomes. It's not impossible. I've heard, and I haven't looked at the legislation, when I was in Scotland, I heard that Queensland, for example, recently, and Queensland is not the most progressive mining jurisdiction, or so I'm told, they've recently passed legislation that's called chain of liability legislation, where they want to hold previous mine operators liable for the costs. We have provisions in our law that we could use, Section 28 of NEMA, for example. But we're not doing that.
Okay,
Honourable Man. I just wanted to check this thing because I think that issue of the rehabilitation fraud came from the question of land use. Whether the return post the extraction is it back to community at its original form, or is it something that has got consequential effects on it? And if that is the case, obviously I am not a scientist myself, but my understanding, which is what I think Honorable Mandela sought to say, because when it comes to the topsoil, I think what RPM said they were doing was that they were taking out the topsoil. But when they do rehabilitation, they will bring back the topsoil. But the question, which is the point I said, is becomes more complex. Whether does it make it to be original? Which the difference with mining, for instance, to agriculture is that you are doing, in agriculture, you are not taking anything out. You are just revamping what is there to develop something else. But even when you harvest, unfortunately, when you harvest the soil, depending what part of the soil you take, the potential of not going back to the original is always there. That was the understanding. The second thing that I think probably, fortunately you are a lawyer, so I'm not saying I'm not going to come back to you, Honorable Larima, such as on this point. Fortunately you are lawyers. I will have to check your Section 28 of NEMA. The problem is that the major parts of your legislation are post-94, post-democratic dispensation. Prior that period, you never had legislation that enforces. Now, there's a general principle of law that says the law can act retrospectively. So even if you are here and you were mining being your name, but the rules or the legislative framework that you were operating under at that time was not enforcing rehabilitation. Now, even if you apply that law, there is a potential it will not succeed. Except if you go for the liability litigation process, which is what you have when it comes to the ex-mine workers. No one wanted to take responsibility or liability until they had to go the litigation route. Now, the bigger question would be, can the state go for, in the absence of a better word, a litigation on soil or whatever erosion or destruction or whatever it is, which will result to your derelict and ownerless mines? Because the difference, that's why I'm saying the application of that law could be, can you hold me liable or responsible for something that you only legislated post-activity? Or should it be a consideration of what you say, that let's go through the process, but in a more cooperative manner, not in a reprieve exercise to say, you did this, and then you must do this, or it should be more like, can we have sense amongst ourselves and say, but you know you are the one who caused this. There is no obligation, but if you make this commitment, then you should understand that then that commitment, it can't be by word of mouth. It must also be true. So I was trying to get that so that we see whether there is something that is enforceable, or it is something that, if I were to use a lower tone, that is a persuasive route that we should consider. But let me allow Honorable Orim.
Can we listen to the answers from yours, because that might affect
So on the question on the topsoil, you know, the way I think about it, it's not
that is just about the layer. It is what you do underneath. You disturb the geohydrology. You fracture the rocks. You mobilize substances that weren't mobilized before. That then start. You change those. You grind them. You create fine tailings. You create huge tailings dumps. So it is about this large scale extractive disturbance that utterly transforms an area. And it's not just ecological, it's social. One of the things that struck me really when I was listening to those hearings last year at the Human Rights Commission was how these poor municipalities have to cope with the influx of people and their systems for water reticulation, you know, just completely overwhelmed, housing overwhelmed, because they've got, so socially the area changes as well. So it's transformative, and so we need to think about, you know, when we're saying it glibly in our law, it must be returned to its natural or predetermined state. What are we really thinking? Are we really apprehending the transformative impact of mining? So that's my thoughts on the topsoil. We need to acknowledge that, and then we need to think what possible economic uses of that land are still possible, and to make sure that we do enough while mining is happening so that we have the widest range of options, that we're not closing our options down. Okay, second point was on the liability. And I think that goes to what we were saying about cooperation. Now, do you want to get embroiled in complicated cases that then talk about, you know, what law was in effect, what was the legal obligation at that time? Do you want to spend your energy on that? Where can this committee have its greatest strategic and systemic impact? Either making sure that we don't have more bridges to abandonment and dereliction, or really trying to go after the old operators. I think there's value in knowing the linkages. It would be interesting to know, like it was interesting for me to find out for Blaise Reitzicht. It was, you know, this company, and then DRD Gold got it here, and then Village Memories. So then we can start talking about people and actors, and we can see linkages. So I think there's value in finding it out. But your impact there, I think, is more moral than actually having a litigation strategy, or you leave that to someone else. That's the incredible stuff that has been happening with silicosis, and that really has taken the mining community by storm. But having said that, I do want to correct the assumption that there weren't laws. There's a judgment from 1937 where somebody was prosecuted for not managing their AMD properly. So we need to stop at this discourse that there weren't laws. There were laws. They weren't as comprehensive as they were today, but certainly for acid mine drainage, there were laws from the early 1930s, 1940s, if not earlier.
Thanks. It's kind of reducing it all. Is there a single example of a closure that's been satisfactorily concluded?
Mm-hmm. Worldwide or in South Africa?
Yeah.
I think it was SLK or SRK or ERM did a global study, and the reports from that study, according to them, were that less than 3% of mines closed globally.
Okay. I was intrigued by partial closure. How would that work, and how would that be done? I'm just going to string them out. To get on to Blaeville, is Skeep mining. It sounds like we don't have any idea of what the rehab fund situation is. Is any rehabilitation happening? Do we know how? So it seems we don't know how much money's been set aside. And does rehabilitation now get shelved until there's a closure certificate? My understanding is mines can't access rehabilitation funds before they get a closure certificate. And the only reason that they do any concurrent rehabilitation is to keep down their annually assessed liabilities. Is that correct? And then there was just Fleurhof. What mine was that? Where is it built?
Okay, I'm trying to get some information on partial closure for you and where it's allowed. So that would be you know, where you have sections of the mind that are stable, and so when you transfer the, I stand to be corrected, but it's been tried in Chile and in Zambia as well. I remember seeing something in their legislation about partial closure. So that you reduce the area that is associated with liability. You know, obviously it's a huge policy shift for us, and we need to look at the implications, but it's just kind of narrowing the problem down. Mm. Sorry, your second question? On Blaeford and the situation of Blaeford. Look, I'm not integrally involved in that case, and the best person to speak there would be Maria Lieferink, who has initiated criminal proceedings against the directors, and that case is not really going anywhere. The last I heard about the trust fund was that there were $36 million in it, but DRD Gold does not want to release it. So the control of those funds, who has it, how much, no one knows. We don't even know if a mining right has been granted to the new developers and where the mining is taking place. The last time, I have a PhD student who's working with artisanal miners in that area. There's just a lot of artisanal mining taking place on that site. Sorry, and then the third question?
The third one was about the access to rehabilitation funds.
My understanding being that mines can't access those rehabilitation funds until they get the closure certificate. And that the only reason that they would do any concurrent rehabilitation is to lower their annually assessed liabilities.
Okay, this is maybe we need to just go back, look at the law. My understanding is that you can access those for decommissioning and closure to get your closure certificate.
It follows on the question I asked, because you then rectified the misimpression I got, I think my colleague got.
Maybe I must go back and look at the MPRDA and the Tax Act. My understanding is that you can use those funds to actually do the decommissioning and closure to get it. And that the change that was introduced for the new financial provision regulations is that you can only use those funds for post-closure. And that was a distinct policy shift that DEA introduced. Because they wanted the mining companies to use their money for annual and progressive rehabilitation. So they put a new provision in those regulations that says you could only use trust funds for residual and latent, which is after you've got your closure certificate. So my understanding of the current situation prior to that was that those trust funds that were established could be used for the closure process, the decommissioning process, and then you would get your closure certificate. Okay. So, but you know, maybe we must go check. But that's what I understand is the situation. Flora, the names of the mining companies, I don't have them at hand. I mean, if you look at that gazette, it's Mine Reef Consolidated or something along those lines. But I do have a postdoc researcher who is investigating the case. I can provide you with the names of those mines.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the issue of the open data portal, it speaks very much to what. Back to the Australian example, because everything there is on a system. You enter the system, you can see who the owners are, you can see who the beneficial owners are, you can see what the shareholding is, you can see what the EIA number is, and when it was approved. Everything is on the system. And the reason why I'm making the point is, especially listed mining companies, their financial data is, in terms of JZ and all similar kind of verses, are compelled to publish that information. And it would be a way of checking on the social responsibility of that particular company. If you're drilling a big hole into the ground, you've got a 5 million rand trust fund, then of course it will show that this company is basically being socially responsible, environmentally responsible. So the similar argument applies to the social labour plan, and it was, as you quite right, sir, only until recently the social labour plan, the DMR came and said they're also now in favour of making that data available, because one mining company doesn't know what the other, what the mining company has committed to doing, and it relies on the say-so of that particular mine company as to what its social labour responsibilities are. So openness and transparency in that regard is of immense value. It creates checks and balances, not only for the mining communities, but also for the shareholders, the investors, and, you know, the wider society. Then one thing on a more legalistic issue. I'm very concerned, and I wasn't aware of it, that in business rescue processes and liquidation process, what is the situation, legal position with regards to those environmental responsibilities? I get the impression what you said, maybe incorrectly, that it just is, well, it's at least not foremost in terms of issues to be dealt with. But does it, I only want to say, fall away? What does a business rescue practitioner and or a liquidator do with those environmental responsibilities from a legal point of view?
Okay.
Thank you for your question. So the open data movement is incredible, and we can be doing so much more with it. And I didn't know what was going on until I was the independent review mechanism researcher for the Open Government Partnership. So I interviewed the people from Treasury that have an incredible process now about open budgeting, so that budgeting information is available, and they've worked together with a civil society group to actually understand what are people's needs for information, to design a system in such a way that then the information is available and then people can play with it. You know, they have these things called hackathons where they get the young guys to come and then they've got to design apps that give you information. So, you know, what about a social and labor plan app where you could go on your phone and you can find out, okay, for this mining company, these are the obligations. That would be incredible. But we have this ridiculous, and I don't understand it, we have this ridiculous culture that we can't release this stuff. Even the documents that were made available to the Human Rights Commission, certain mining companies insisted that they could not be disclosed. Social and labor plans. You have communities that don't even know what the social and labor plan is. So this is a grave area of concern, and it's really hampering us in moving forward together and solving these problems in an innovative way. It's about creativity that is being stifled through the lack of information. So, you know, as I see the main initiative within government now is the open data portal that is being run by the DPSA. Zaid Abubakar is the person, and he's been trying to work with government departments to encourage them to put their data on this open data portal, and the contract for that has been awarded. So it's really something that can be taken up. On the question of the business rescue practitioner, the processes differ. So you've got fundamental transactions, which is really trying to protect the minority shareholders, and there's no disclosure. It's actually quite it's not a very tight regulatory process. So it's just trying to make sure that the minority shareholders are protected in those processes. So interested and affected parties, relevant parties, don't even come into play there. So you can sell a major mine, and it can be a major part of your assets, and it just doesn't feature. Business rescue is a bit different. The main policy objective there is to try and get your financially distressed company to avoid liquidation. And then you've got a definition of relevant stakeholders and affected persons. But those definitions don't include, like, the environment or custodians of the environment. They're not part of the relevant and affected parties. So, for example, it says the business rescue practitioner must consult with affected parties in company management. So that there's no consultation duty. However, because this is recent legislation, you do have more than the liquidation processes, which is from 1970s, you do have points of articulation. So, for example, the business rescue practitioner must, there is a notification requirement. And there is this, what I mentioned, if the regulatory authorities want to take action, if they want to have some kind of fine or, you know, suspension of activities linked to the environmental management plan, they can do that. They're not prevented from doing it. It's section 133(1) of the Companies Act. So as long as they notify the business rescue practitioner, it doesn't mean that's just hands up, which is the impression I got from Deputy Minister Willy Funt's presentation on Monday. So there's a lack of understanding of what is available. The one that is most concerning is the winding up. Chapter 14 of the Companies Act 1973, which is really, I mean, mine closure as an idea worldwide was only developing at that point. So it really doesn't, the processes don't speak to our current realities for mining companies. And it's generic legislation. I mean, it's how can you use the same winding up procedure for a shoe factory and a mine? We need something different because it has its scale and impact. It is just a different ballgame. And there you could close a mine without anyone being any, you could wind up the company deregister the company without anyone being the wiser.
Okay. Okay, Honorable Pigeon.
No, mine is simple, Jim. I'm interested in the industry, simple here.
Oh, no, thank you very much. I think this research is going to help us a lot in going forward. But I only want to ask around the issue of open data portal, because I can see that it's very advantageous if you use it as one portal. But also, I will pass just a comment that the problem without my learnings from Australia and here, the only problem in South Africa, we are mining within ourselves, within our communities. Now, in Australia, it's far away. People travel a lot. There's no bearing between Zamazamas and them. You get the point. So we have to travel. Also take a flight to go where they are working. So that's where it's not easy really to be managed like us in South Africa. Up there's a problem that you're talking about, the issue of effects on the land itself. I'm interested also in the issue of the social labor plan. You know, I know it was not part of yours. I would be very happy if you can get deeper on it, and SLP. Not now. Because at least I think the interest of workers, they always come first. All these effects that we talk about at the end of the day, it also goes to through the workers if they are not looked after, because it becomes a government problem at a later stage. Yeah, thank you very much. I wanted to just raise this matter.
Comment on that
one? Anu Pikinini, thank you for your question, comments. So on the social and labour plan, the organisation that's doing the most cutting-edge work on that is the Centre for Applied Legal Studies, and they've brought out two reports where they obtained 40 social labour plans and just did a kind of desktop study of those social labour plans, and then they've actually gone to the communities where those social labour plans are supposed to be implemented and spoken to people. So it's very evidence-based. I'd refer you to that. I can provide you with the names of the reports and further contact people there. On the issue of open data and the different context between Australia and South Africa, yes, but then isn't that even all the more reason why we must have, because people in the urban areas are being affected, they live in these environments, is it even more reason why we shouldn't have openness of data where people can easily access, you know, understanding what is happening in the environment? So for me it's just an argument. It just strengthens the argument, actually. It makes it imperative.
Okay, thank you very much, Prof. It's well appreciated. I always say when you are here, it doesn't mean you won't be here again. We think that in some areas it's opening up our eyes. We might have to consider, so that we've got one of the busiest schedule on the one-day meetings. Half a day. I think we take the point around the Human Rights Commission. It's something that we might have to consider whether we can't have them to say on the findings that they might have had, what is it that they would be able to share with us. Regrettable, they did invite me. Is that the way of invitation and how Parliament works sometimes it becomes more complex, but something that we can share with them. I think we'll take that note, that into consideration to say what is it that they can share with us. Two, we have already asked the department to say, I think what you presented now just augment that to say how deeper can we go. To say that can they do or draw up a overall cost, but how do they arrive at that cost itself when it comes to the DOE, so that we know what we are talking about. It might then help us that when we engage both with the mining houses, whether through their associations, we at least speak from a point of strength to say, here are, this is the level of devastation that has been done in terms of the rehabilitation processes. It might be something also that the Portfolio Committee on the Environmental Affairs is doing, so we'll have to see whether we should interact with them very closely, as well as the water and sanitation, like the what you brought in there, so that where there are areas of regulatory defects or limitations, we don't have to then say, no, this one goes there, this one goes there. We collectively say we look at this thing. So that's why I said we'll have to look at this together with the, what should be the shortest way of doing it. But we think that from our side, we will have to make those considerations, especially with the Human Rights Commission, as well as to what extent. I think the department has given us the, that breakdown. It's something that we'll have to come back and engage with it from a committee point of view and see whether it's sufficient enough or consistent with what we have requested. Honourable Smith?
Thank you, Monsieur. I don't want to steal your thunder, but I just want to ask, you know, I know that universities do a lot of research, and sometimes students do, to their research, they attach documents saying this is how they think the MPRDA, for instance, should be amended. Now, those kind of stuff could assist, and especially with regards to presentation to the committee when amendment to a bill has been made. I found that that interaction is not always there. The knowledge is there, but the interaction with the committee when an amendment bill is to be discussed is not always the practical proposals as to how to amend the act is not always. What I'm trying to say in a very lopsided way is there's not always a bridge between the theoretical knowledge and the practical way in which an act should be amended. And that's maybe one thing what one can work on, I suppose, from the committee side as well as from the academic side, is to how does one get some of these proposals, what you've now suggested, in a practical way before the committee, to at least make us aware and to help practically implement amendments. Thank you
for that suggestion. I have incredible PhD students. I have 9 PhD students, and some of them are working, you know, really squarely. I have one student who's now doing work on live on ASM miners and how we can regulate ASM miners from a livelihood perspective. He's about to start his empirical research. I have another student who's now looking at post-mine closure and climate adaptation and working with Chikondeni mine. I have another student working on free prior and informed consent in various extractive projects, and then other sort of environmental related ones. So I would love to have that research to come there, and I certainly will consider how we can make it digestible for this committee so that it doesn't waste your time and really you can use it in the processes. Thank you.
Dr. Nicole will always be your point of call.
Okay.
Okay, thanks very much, Prof. You are excused.
Okay.
Honourable members, can we then go to the minutes? Of the 11th, it's a one pager or two pager. On page 1, on page 2, over. Honorable Mande.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to move for the adoption of the minutes dated 11th of October 2017 as a true reflection of the meeting, and therefore I move for the adoption. Thank you.
Mr. Kenda? Honorable Pigini?
Yes, second chair. Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay, any matters arising?
Any matters arising? Okay. Minutes of the 18th. Of October 2017. Page 1. I can't say 2018. I don't know how we need to. You must always have a sense of humor. Tense meetings don't help. Page 2, on page 2, that's my own, you tell me if I'm wrong, there it says 1, 2, 3, 4, sentence 4, towards the end, start with Mr. Lorima, tell me if I'm wrong. It says Mr. Lorima has raised the matter with the public protector. I thought it also said and the registrar of members' interest. Ne? You call it like that?
Yes.
Okay. I'm very careful now. Eh? then the second one to me. It says, I think it's a second paragraph, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The fifth sentence, towards the end again. It's supposed to say, in conclusion, he informed the committee. Tell me if I'm wrong. Okay. If none, on page 2, can we go to page 3? For me, on page 3, bullet point 1, 2, 3, although it also does appear somewhere down there, bullet point 1, 2, 3. It says, did he miss the booked return flight to Dubai and travel with a private jet of the Guptas? I think it was saying to India. Am I correct?
Correct.
Okay. Any matter on page 5? Oh, no, man. No, I can't be like Honorable Schmidt, Matlala, and Nyambi. My two eyes, they don't need support system. I didn't say check off you.
You need them sometimes.
Okay. Page 4, you see, I look at 3, it's like 5. It means there is something there. As long as I can still see you. That
might be technical English, bullet point 1, 2, 3, 4 from the bottom. The minister said that he does not own a choir, but he does. So that part should be not a capital letter, it should be a comma. But he does sing for a gospel group. You can still put that if you like. He said he's an artist and he grew up with the choir. So I was just saying, in summary, he does sing for a gospel group without going into detail. Any other matter? Any outstanding information? Okay. Any move of the minutes? Honorable Mafolo?
I move for adoption of the minutes with the correction. Thank you, Chair.
Any second? Honorable Mandel?
Thank you, Chair. I support the adoption of the minutes of the 18th of October 2017 with amendments as a true reflection of the meeting. Second, Chair.
Okay. Matters arising, there was only one item. Honorable members, I had thought now your colleague is not here, Honorable Schmidt. I don't know whether, and no one from the FF, not that I mention you by political party. The last time we finished, we agreed, and I've written to the minister to say, can he give us a date? And hopefully, maybe next week. The fact of the matter is that time is of essence. Now, I wanted us to then, I've also written without your permission, and accept my apology in advance. I've written to the legal unit of parliament to say we appreciate if they could be here, and we hope they will be here next week, so that they can help and assist to guide us on what will be the next process. Two, I would have loved, for the sake of time, to get a sense of how much honorable members would need for the questions next time when we meet. Because it's then gonna help us to then cut off some time. For an example, don't think I'm proposing that. I would have proposed, that's why I said, if Honorable Lorema and Jafta and would have been here and from the FF, so that we take a collective view, maybe to cut off at 11, I'm just making an example, and from that time, when we've been done with the question, we simultaneously immediately deal with what then do we want to see being the process going forward, or allow the legal services, if that person they so provide, to assist us to say what then should be the next process. Otherwise, we are going to be faced with a difficult situation where we will finish and then we'll have to wait for another day to reconvene and now discuss. Even the worst thing is that it's not automatic, we'll agree. I'm not saying we will not, but it's going to be a discussion that on its own, it might take its own time on what has to be done. So now I don't want to put you on the spot, Honorable Schmidt, because you might be the only ones. From the ANC, if they commit themselves, they are all here. So no one would say, no, I was not there. But can we leave? But can I make a request that when we come next week, two requests that I should make. When we come next week, no, not next week, because I still have to wait for the answer, but we are planning that to request the minister to come back next week. He's abroad this week. Then we deal with the issue and finish at 11. We will try and request in our application that we go at least up until 1 o'clock instead of 12:30. We will then be dealing, if legal services, if you can, Ayanda, or anyone who can guide the committee, what are the possible options, but to request members, for the sake of this committee, to try our level best. Again, no one is limited, but to focus on what should be, so that when we deal with as a committee, we also deal, I would fear a situation where we'll have a debate about where does this entirely lies and where does it doesn't lie. With the experience that I have here, maybe I must disclose. Sometimes we discuss things, then you meet people in the corridors and say, hey, you have stopped now being the committee on mineral resources, you are the committee on other matters. Because they feel that issues that we are dealing with here, they don't necessarily belong to us, they belong to them, to other committees. That's why I'll be frank and honest, I don't think environment will have a problem. That's why I was making that statement to say, when we deal with this question of derelict and ownerless mine, it is more of a threat to environment. Therefore, we might need the committee on environment. So when environment comes and say, hey, you are even discussing matters that we are dealing with them ourselves, so we must take them on board. So I'm just saying, I would love, even when members come back, we also give ourselves space, so that when we discuss and finally agree on what will be the way forward, we can then go back. If there is more work that needs to be done, we can go back and develop a plan that will then say, based on this, we will need so much time, we will need this and that to the House Chairperson, because we can't just do as we wish. If there is still more, like the Minister said, I'll be honest, if the Minister said, you want to see Fred the farm, you are welcome. You see, we can't just wake up and say, no, we're going to Fred. But someone might stand up and say, you are going to Fred, since when are you the Committee on Agriculture? Or since when are you representing the Free State Legislature? I'm just making an example. I'm not saying those are some of the things that the final analysis will have to deal with them. I'm as prepared as possible to make sure that everything, we must put it bare. We must deal with issues and carry each other along. The last thing I must say, when we deal with that thing, and I will say it next time, I'm that type of a person who says, put your point as much as you like. But I always say, from my point of view, there's no reason for me, I'll be frank and honest, there's no reason for me to be rude because I'm making a point. I can still make a point, it goes, but I know when we deal with some of them, they've got emotions in it. I'm prepared as a chairperson to be the one who's sacrificed, just by trying to be as fair as possible to everyone and anyone. I've said this and I will say it again next time. I've sat in board meetings. What I know, immediately you enter, then become a board member, whoever constituency nominated you to that board is no longer relevant. What is relevant is that you have to do the work. So I treat all of you as people who belong to this committee. It's immaterial which party you come from. But if what you say is supposed to make sense, even if it doesn't make sense, the only time that I will make a judgment is when what the manner in which as honorable members we treat and handle each other. I think we must agree there is a certain standard, there is a certain level, there is a certain example that we must send to our people. Otherwise, I always say, when leaders fight, don't expect that people are going to keep quiet. If I can't insult you, I'll be honest, I can't insult you. Otherwise, members of the DA, they will come back and say, this is how our member has been treated. Sometimes we insult each other here, we go outside, we shake hands and laugh and everything that was happening here is gone. But from the people who are following us, it's not gone, it's retaining in their minds, and they think that there is war looming. Mm. So I'm just saying, I will do my level best to make sure that this process runs as much as we could. But let's deal with that issue next time, and I hope Babunka Bin, the Netim Balako, you will help us. But to me, as soon as we dispense with this matter, we then must be able to say, because finally, we will have to go and say, here is the report that the committee is presenting. Thank you very much, Honorable Member, or Honorable Mander.
Thank you, Chair. I thought it necessary, Chair, to also give input in terms of what you have contributed. It's paramount that honorable members in the committee must be protected at all costs, regardless of what party they belong to. You know, in the session we are from, honorable members were insulted grossly. You can't refer to a member of this august house and say that he's mad. You cannot say to a member of this committee, this old man. You cannot say to a member of committee, this boy. Because then you are allowing the meeting to degenerate. But those things need to be attended to and dealt with. So we would request for your protection and request that you don't allow such things or utterances to be the order of the day that dominate our discussions. But also, Chair, on another issue, perhaps to ascertain, I thought in the meeting we seemed to put questions to the minister and he answered the questions. And there was an allusion of we've run out of time. But I was hoping that you will put it to us. Do we actually have questions to put to the minister that they are still hanging, particularly in the balance of mineral resources? Because we can say that we have questions, and again tomorrow I can come up with a question, are you a friend to Atul Gupta? But what's that got bearing on mineral resources? So I thought honorable members will try and utilize this meeting to at least give guidance as to do we have more questions, where are these questions structured so that we are able to assist the process in terms of time. But I'm not opening a discussion, Chair. I was hoping that if honorable members still have questions, they may be able to consult with you and dedicate or request for time, if it's 30 minutes or if it's an hour, to this process. But we need to ensure that the work of the committee is done, Honorable Chair. Thank you.
Honorable Smith.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I can't speak on behalf of anyone else, but I do have questions. There are questions which I need to ask. I have no particular view as to 1 hour, 3 hours, 5 hours. I mean, if we can aim for 11 o'clock, as long as you exercise your discretion that if we're not finished, we continue a bit longer. If we finish earlier, well, then we finish earlier. But, sometimes comments need to go and do not need to be responded on, and it just is the best way of dealing with it. So I know what Mr. Mandela is referring to, but to make a big issue about someone making a nasty comment, sometimes better just to let go than to make a big fuss of it, because then it becomes the issue of the meeting instead of other issues, Mr. Chair.
No, that's why I said, and may repeat, that's why I said when I run that meeting and every meeting, I come to a meeting, let me give an example. We are dealing with rehabilitation. This is the presentation on environment. Any other matter, I always say, put it aside. Then when we deal with ourselves, because the problem is that you bring in a minister here, you ask, and then there is an exchange. By the time you realize you have not done anything, achieved anything, except to say you were just throwing insults and so forth at each other. So that's why, Honorable Mandela, I did it. I know it might sound bad that I suppressed other people. I deliberately knew that if I allow a response, the meeting is going to degenerate. The second thing is that I can't at this stage to say, members, bring your questions. No. You see, there are many things that have been said. As long as I know that there is no rule of parliament, every member has got a right if that member feels that I'm acting outside the rules of parliament. So that's what guides me, or the constitution. The point is that members want to ask questions. It's just a request, Honorable Smith. It's not that I'm forcing members. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest. The problem is that, and I made an example, Honorable Jafta serves in another committee. Honorable Piginini is in economic development. Honorable Matlala is in energy. Honorable Nyambi is in environment. You are still in telecommunications. So you then have, I don't know, we're not even seeing him. His apology we accepted, but the fact of... So in essence, let's be honest, in this committee we've got yourself, Honorable Lorima, Honorable Mandela, and the chairperson. So we shouldn't pretend as if we're not sharing members with other committees, regardless which political party they belong to. So my appeal, therefore, is based that where we can get members in maximum, let's utilize that time to our benefit. So if members would say, let's extend time, I'm saying, I can guarantee you, what is the date next week? 20? No. It's the 1st. By the 1st of December, let's be honest, we won't be here. That's why I'm being practical. We won't be here. In essence, it means we're left with only 3 Wednesdays, if I'm not mistaken. 3 Wednesdays. So in this, I'm talking about our own time. 3 half days. On Wednesday. Now, if we next week we don't deal with that way forward, which is not guaranteed that the following week it will be kicking in, it actually suggests, and I'll be honest, you won't get these members of, I don't want to hide things, I'm open, we won't get those members of the ANC because they've got a conference in December. I'm being honest. It's not that, no, you see, sometimes we like to hide things when they are there, they are bad. You won't get them. And here we've got a work of parliament to perform. Even if we take them there, it will mean it's going to have cost implications. So we still have to send this program. Even if we say this is how we go forward, we'll have to send, cost it, and then send it to the House Chair. We may, by the time we meet the following week, the House Chair may not have finalized what would have requested from a committee. So I'm just saying, if we were to take this question, ordinarily I would have said, let's get 1 hour, but I don't want to suppress someone. If members won't continue beyond 11 o'clock, I can't stop you. But I always say, my understanding is that, and I think we'll clarify that issue that day, we have not started with an inquiry, because the letter from the House Chair said, start with the executive authority, with the member of the executive, to ask questions, and then based on what you would have got from the member of the executive, you then talk about what will be the way forward. Amongst those, it could be some form of an inquiry. We may even have to debate what type of an inquiry do we follow. I'll be honest, the existing example of what you have in public enterprise, how much is it going to take us? So that's why I'm saying if we meet on Wednesday, next week, and the minister is available, hopefully. But if the minister is not available, we will still have to discuss his non-availability. And we know what will be the route if you want to force him to appear in front of the committee. I'm just saying, the minister has never been unavailable. I'm not saying this time around he's going to be unavailable. I'm just saying, let's look at all the cons and pros. So I'm just, my appeal, as I said, let's deal with the issue next week. It will still be matters arising because we have adopted the minutes, and hopefully the minister will be available. But my appeal, can we utilize that time effectively for the benefit of the committee? On that note, is there any other matter? No announcement? Leave it to me at this, okay? Okay, leave it. Okay, you are released.
That was a great. what a brilliant thing.
What a brilliant thing. What a brilliant
thing. What a